Western intellectual tradition. And eventually, when the aspirations of that capital hits a certain critical mass, then the folks in charge of how things work have got to figure out what to do about that. And certainly in the 19th century in this country, what people did about that was shoot folks or move them off or do what needed to be done. And the Western intellectual tradition had evolved to a point so that in 1971 that wasn't acceptable. So people had to be cashed out. But I don't really think that you could describe that as a negotiation. But certainly because Charlie and some folks were able to trap that accumulation of capital, some deal of some fashion had to be cut. And one of the concerns I have about trying to go back and redo it is how you can recreate that kind of situation where you can at least play a couple of hands around the table sort of way out on the edge. And the thing that has always struck me, again, not knowing anything about really the details of your aspirations over there, is I've not been aware that there's really been the push, you know, of the native, of the pipeline like we had in Alaska or the dams in James Bay that really gave the oomph to have those people have to sit down and deal you folks out and have to be able to look at themselves in the mirror. So I guess my first question is whether or not my current assessment of the situation is correct, and it's always subject to change. And second is, if it is correct, then do you really think you're going to have the kind of luck that you're going to have? And if you really do think that that's going to be the case, then I think there might be some lessons from the techniques that you're using that would help folks here to be able to go back in and take another bite out of the apple. Or maybe we're just, maybe this is pie in the sky and maybe it's not a realistic expectation to think that Congress is going to be willing to sit down and really talk straight with folks. So whoever wants to take a crack at that.
I'll take a crack at it. For the record, I'm Charles Edwardson, Jr. I was the only Alaska Native that have spent more time on this matter than all of our elected officials in Washington, D.C. So if seniority of occupation matters on a consideration, let me tell you that it was not very positive. What had happened to the Alaska Native people is very simply that they had been promised 107 years ago that their destiny was to be resolved sometimes in the future. So what happened in 1965 was I had seen the deterioration of this promise that has been given to us. And so the utmost good faith of government is completely non-existent. And if our experience is an example, the greatest American problem, as I see it, is the illiteracy of in constitutional law, incompetence in administration, and management by greed. And so in this context, the Alaska Native people did not negotiate. So they were given hodgepodge of time, and what had happened was we caught the Democratic Party in its weakest moments thinking that they are the principal agents of human rights. And we found out that was not the case. The case was, although that they are liberal in nature, conservative in natural resources for the simple fact that they're going to give you not rights, but a pastoral appetite, where that they give you and let you come and talk to them, drink their coffee, smoke their cigars, have their women, and maybe they'll send you home drunk. I went through Alaska Native Land Claims completely drunk, as a circumstance for some people. They said, "Ah, that guy, he can't handle himself. But let me tell you, that's the only way that I can tolerate some white people is to be completely drunk. And so the premise, the very premise when you open the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act is that it was to be fair and just. What I found out was I thought that we were going to negotiate. So when I concluded the settlement, I started out with a claim of 93 million people, 93 million acres. And in 1971, it dwindled down to 5.7 million acres. Was that fair and just? And the basic premise that America is a constitutional government, it only appears on paper. And so in the American context, I studied what the American Revolution was all about. I found out some basic, for your information, that in America, United States, that is, that your property was not supposed to be stolen or used without your permission. And so I thought this was the case. So I spent about something like in the neighborhood of $10 million in about 15-year period, and found out that I only had pastoral rights, that I did not have Fifth Amendment rights, that the use of oil was something technical and non-existent for the Eskimo. But when you take a look at historical use of oil and gas, my culture, the Eskimo people have been in the oil business longer than the entire history of the Anglo-Saxon community. We've been in the whale business. And what most people do not know at this time is that these whaling companies are now oil companies. So when you take a look at the historical use and occupancy, they will steal from you and give you a right something less than what the Constitution says. It says, by God, it does not pertain to, the Fifth Amendment only applies to white folks, blacks, and others. And so the American context and why ANCSA is such a bad model is we got lucky and convinced the White House that there should be some settlement. And so we had to fight our own people, our own state. The greatest anathema to native rights is state of Alaska and the oil companies that received benefits from its leases. And in this context, that the greatest loss to Alaskan people have been the mismanagement and the misinterpretation of the disclaimer clause in the Alaska Statehood Act. Here is the United States administration with a constitution and an enabling act called the Statehood Act. I view the Statehood Act as a surrender document for all of the white people. And since 1959, the 25 years of statehood, I have seen subversions of all of Alaska's renewable resources leaving Alaskan hands. Now our oil and gas and minerals is controlled by multinational corporations, and with state of Alaska with no mineral policy. And the fishermen, the fish in the high seas is completely Japanese, Korean, Chinese, Russian, and Great Britain. Why Great Britain? Because state of Alaska, in its wisdom, has not seen the energy companies to go into other enterprises. And so what state of Alaska ended up with is the additional 40-some-odd million acres that we had gotten away from the Federal Register into private hands is now being lost fastly to incompetent management, to debt service. So all of the gains that have been made by Alaska Native Land Claims are going to be lost in a bankruptcy court. And the greatest threat that the Alaska Native people see, what I tried to do in the 60s and the 70s was that the Alaska Native leadership opted for the political friendship of these dumb Anglo-Saxons here who know less than we do about our own future, for the friendship and the limited liability that they enslaved the rest of the Alaska Native, when there was an option for sovereign immune instruments. The basic cultural dichotomy about Alaska is that it left the norm. The Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement left the norm and opted for a state configuration without changing the state of Alaska's disclaimer clause that says state of Alaska and its people shall forever disclaim any right and title of hunting and fishing rights in the future. And this is the basic fallacy of constitutional rights in America, is that the Constitution is only a pastoral document.
Charlie, before I ask the Canadian panel to respond to my question, I mean, I think your statement proves my point. I mean, my point was that the dominant political system started paying lip service to Native claims in the 1880s. There were Claims Act bills of various kinds introduced in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And there was lots of cheap talk, but nobody ever would face up to it until you hung them up because of the interests of the oil industry and other folks. And then, I mean, I would agree with you, then you still got trashed. But to the extent that you got a chance to play in the game at all, it was because you trapped them. And my point is it possible to play without trapping them, either in Canada or having to do it again here at home to get another bite of the apple? And that was my question.
I think that if you keep Native rights according to the doctrine of federal preemption, that you can always trap a secondary instrument like a state. So under a rigid federal authority, where this preemption is so clear, such as it is in the Alaska disclaimer clause that you could play the weak versus the strong more fluently in an American format, which you cannot do in a Canadian context for the simple fact that they have just arrived to a constitution. So the American experience is not easily transferable to Canada for the simple fact that the Canadians today and their ancestral heritage tells me, and if history is correct, that they had opted for King George's version of and so the basic separation, I think that if we take the Treaty of Paris as a living document in line with the Jay Treaty, the boundary dispute between Russia and the United States and Great Britain in 1825, and to take that Russian treaty to Treaty of 1867, and the Treaty of 1867 gives us and gives me some hope for the simple fact that the oil companies were so sloppy when they lost to me on Section 4. What a lot of people do not know was when everybody else went home, left Washington, D.C., and went home after the 40 million acres was achieved and got a pass from the White House for 40 million acres, then I was abandoned in Washington, D.C. Everybody else went home. Why the settlement is so bad is the last 6 weeks. I was the only one in Washington, D.C., holding the American dike, and I failed. And the only thing that I succeeded is the Section 4, the extinguishment clause is not perfect. And so I see the Alaska Native Land Claims Review Commission as a forum to further inform the Americans that they did not secure the good faith of the Native people for the simple fact that their utmost good faith was non-existent. And so the Secretary of Interior is not without responsibility, and the Republican tenure in Congress in 1862, when the U.S. Court of Claims was created, that Congress had usurped some executive powers and directed the office of the office of the president incompetent to negotiate with Indians. They took a separation of powers away from the president and says, Mr. President, you are no longer going to make treaties. And to this day, the separation doctrine argument on that question is not fully determined. And then on top of that, I also later had a horrible experience that I could not pay my attorney, that I could not hire an attorney. So what that means is that the Indians are without the resources of the Fifth Amendment completely, that your right of counsel is not a right. It is pastoral with the consent of the Secretary of Interior. So to take a look at what has happened to Alaska Natives and the tribes in the lower 48, the greatest mistake that they had, that the Alaska Native people made, was they could have easily administered this under a federated enclave. The as bad as the Indian Reorganization Act is, it is the only element in American law that I feel was not extended to Alaska Natives. I am quite positive to this day, had the people of Alaska had the opportunity to vote and cast their ballot at the time of secession, that they would have had rejected the settlement.
I think that we have time for some observations from Steve Cacfui or any other of the Dene Métis group. And then I think we should adjourn because Bill Dubé has arranged the visit to the North Slope Borough computer mapping project, and then come back this afternoon to hear from the Nunavut Constitutional Forum, the ITC, and from the Australians and the Sami again before we adjourn. All right. The Aboriginal Australians. Anything to add just before we go to lunch, Steve Cacfui? Maybe I could just make an observation just before we leave that I think that Don Mitchell's observation has a lot to be said for it. That is that in Alaska, the Claims Act was in a sense the product of a large pool of oil being discovered at Prudhoe Bay and the need for bringing it to market. In James Bay, the land claim settlement was precipitated by the need to proceed with a large hydroelectric project. But over the last 2 days, it became apparent that the settlement in the Western Arctic by the Committee for Original Peoples Entitlement, the Inuvialuit, has apparently come about without the impetus of any single large-scale industrial project in that region. And I think it is even more apparent that for the Council of Yukon Indians, their agreement has not been the product of a drive for industrial development that takes the form of a specific project. So I think that with your permission, Steve Cacfui.
If I could say a little bit about that. I think I differ a little because the pressure to make an agreement with the Committee for Original Peoples Entitlement is because of the massive interest of oil companies in the Beaufort Sea and in the Mackenzie Delta. With the Yukon Indians, the pressure was from the Yukon non-native people. The Council of Yukon Indians, I understand, had put a land freeze on about half of the Yukon territory. And in order to get it out, they have to also come to a sort of agreement with the Yukon Indians. The added momentum to these negotiations was federal political interest in Ottawa. The present Minister of Indian Affairs in Canada, the Honorable John Munro, had some very high political aspirations and wanted very much to finish his term, which is up in a short while, to achieve one or two agreements. And those are caused the progress that occurred with these respective groups to the point that they have. I guess our own view, and it's what Charlie Edwardson is saying and Don Mitchell, I don't think, and same with Shorty here, that I don't think it is that the initiative of people like ourselves that we want to give up large portions of our land. And you know, the tremendous amount of giving up that we have to do in extinguishing. But we also have to look at the fact that we need to negotiate some sort of arrangement. And so we look for, as you would say, the night when the devil's in town, you know, when all the pressures are there and the conditions are right, then you see if you're brave enough to dance with the devil and see what you get to take home that night. That's what the attitude I have about a comprehensive claim. You know, it's dangerous business and very emotional. It's you're not going to be a winner at all, but you do what you have to get something out of the circumstances.
Right.
So we all keep, I think, in mind whatever levers we need and are required in order for negotiations to start and for negotiations to keep going.
Thank you. I think that is a more complete picture than I was able to give. Mike Albert of Tununuk, we'll give you the last word before lunch, and then we'll have to move on after that.
Thank you, Mr. Berger, for the opportunity for me to give me a chance to speak right here again. I come here from Tununuk, and there's a number of group with me that come here to attend this meeting here. And we have concerns and goals that have no difference in yours. What I would like to see right now is that when
we can come back this afternoon, Mr. Albert.
When Alaska became state, that there was only a handful of people when they signed the seal of Alaska to the United States. That's what suffered me and suffered everybody in my own village. And then, in second time, when Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act was being enacted, only a handful of people signed for that, and that's serious to it. My question is, why didn't the real landowners of Alaska, was not discussed first before everything was signed? Why didn't people of Alaska, real owners of the land, be discussed before Alaska was transferred to become a state of the United States? And why didn't the people of Native Eskimos in Alaska be discussed before the Land Settlement Act was made? That's all I want to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Well, I think we'll adjourn for lunch and come back at 1:30, and we'll hear from the Nunavut Constitutional Forum. I think that it woke us all up. Yeah, nice to see you. We could begin. Even though the Dene Métis contingent is absent, it may be that they were overwhelmed by the excitement of the proceedings this morning. But I think we should start now so that we will have time to consider the what is said by the Nunavut Forum, and then have still, I hope, time left for the people from Australia to speak, and then Alf Isaac Cascatello from Sami Land. And so perhaps, Peter Atinwar, you might just open the subject up. Daly, do you want to sit over there?
Sure.
Bring your name card. All right, well, Peter Atinwar, go right ahead. And
thank you, Justice Berger. We from the Eastern Arctic of Canada are here partly in recognition of your history as a Native claims worker, especially in the Calder case and certainly in the Mackenzie Valley pipeline hearings, and rather Mackenzie Valley hearings. So, as well as the interest we have in political status of indigenous claims throughout the world. In this context, I must mention that the Alaska claim for us has not been one of real influence, at least directly in our case. We've been aware of it for many, many years. We have never, as Makivik did, or the NQIA did, come over to Alaska to specifically study the technical aspects of the corporation structures, etc. So I must say that the Alaskan model has never been one that we followed very closely. I suppose we could also say a few things about historical injustices or historical hardships, but I'm going to skip over that. My colleagues are rather long-winded, and they'll take up some time, I believe. I will say this, following up on the history of the Australians, the Eskimos or Inuit in Canada only became able to vote federally in 1960. That's not very long ago. As I've mentioned earlier, we are here in two parts. We have the Nunavut Constitutional Forum. We have also the Tungavik Federation of Nunavut. The Nunavut Constitutional Forum is doing the work for a political institutionalization of a government in roughly north of the tree line in the Northwest Territories. The Tungavik Federation is the ethnic part of the total package, whereby they are negotiating through the comprehensive land claims policy of the government things that whereby Eskimos in the Eastern Arctic will be the beneficiaries. Randy Ames certainly will cover that more than adequately. I must mention that Dennis Patterson is the chairman of the Nunavut Constitutional Forum. This perhaps is commentary on our attitudes towards inter-ethnic relations. I don't think I should really say much more about that unless somebody asked. This morning there were connotations and allegations of superiority, inferiority in terms of ethnicity, and this is something for us, something that we've always tried to avoid. I must quote a man whom you've had fundamental differences with, Justice Berger, and this is Prime Minister Trudeau. Unfortunately, Justice Berger, I admire both of you. Well, that's not the unfortunate part, but unfortunately, I have to quote a man. At the recent First Minister's Conference, he referred to Nunavut several times in his official opening statement. If I recall correctly, he said that the federal government is ready to give favorable consideration to the Inuit proposal for a government or self-government in the Eastern Arctic namely Nunavut. Well, following that, I must now refer to the semantic anomaly that was alluded to by Charles Edwardson, that was namely the plebiscite of April 14th, 1982, which for the most part indicated that territorial residents wanted division of the territories. Subsequently, the federal government recognizing that the plebiscite was, while it's not a law, but a true indication of people's wishes by polls, the federal government in November 26th of 1982 recognized in principle the division of the Northwest Territories and for the creation of two new governments gave us a number of conditions which we have to meet in order to create these governments and in order for partition to happen, in order to have a division of the Northwest Territories. And these conditions were continuing consensus for division. There's no doubt about that in the Eastern Arctic, as was indicated this morning. There was some mixed results in the western portion of the Northwest Territories. I will not say why this happened, but hopefully in the future this consensus will include all of the western portion. As well, we have to define the division of powers between Ottawa and our respective governments. Through the WCF-NCF process, we are doing this. You heard from the WCF this morning and how far they've gone. We will try and indicate to what extent we've tried to define these division of powers. As one of the conditions included also the settlement of claims. Now, this is in reference to the comprehensive claims that Randy Ames is involved in, or the Tungavik Federation of Nunavut is involved in. I may mention something further to this after the statements by my colleagues. There has been some development in this as a condition by the federal government. Last and certainly not least is the question of the boundary. You heard a proposal by the, or at least reference to it by the Western, our Western colleagues. This boundary has to be settled between the WCF and the NCF through the alliance. There are quite a number of factors involved in the settling this boundary, and we have to hopefully settle it soon because of the time frame of the political climate in Canada, which I will elaborate on later if necessary. From here, I think, Mr. Chairman, as I've said, I should mention one thing. I'm on instruction from Peter Green, president of COPE, on his behalf to say that unequivocally they are a member of the Nunavut Constitutional Forum. There is no question of where they will be from here until the boundary is settled and the two territories are stated. As for the elements and features of the Nunavut government, I will now have the chairman of the Nunavut Constitutional Forum go into a fair amount of detail as he is wont to do, and then we will have Randy Ames talk about the Tungavik Federation land claims process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dennis?
Thank you, Mr. Atinwar. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That fanfare was part of our presentation. I hope you appreciate it. Mr. Chairman, in order to talk about Nunavut, which is a proposal for a territorial form of government, I'd like to describe briefly some features of the existing territorial government in the Northwest Territories. I've passed around the annual report of the Legislative Assembly of the Government of the Northwest Territories. It will give you much more detail than I will give here, but let me just describe briefly the government of the Northwest Territories, because that's the model that we are basing our form of self-government in Nunavut upon. Basically, the Northwest Territories has an advantage not enjoyed by any of the groups that are represented here today, in that Native people are a two-thirds majority in the Northwest Territories. We have a fairly healthy budget for a population of around 50,000. The operating budget this year is over $500 million, and it's increased by about 15% in each of the last 2 years. I like to think because we're good negotiators with the federal government, which funds 80% of the budgetary requirements of the Northwest Territories. Since 1979, when there was a Native majority in the Legislative Assembly, that Native majority has dominated the character of the government, has formed the character of the government of the Northwest Territories, and I think have increased their representativeness in the government. And currently, as of the recent 1983 elections in this fall, there's an even higher majority of Native persons in the Legislative Assembly, a total of 8 Inuit and 6 Dene members, which means 14 out of 24. But really, it's greater than that, because people like myself and 2 other non-Inuit, non-Native MLAs from the eastern part of the Northwest Territories also represent constituencies which have a majority of Inuit, in some cases a very high majority of Inuit. And I think, following on what Peter Itinuar said earlier, the fact that non-Native persons like myself and my other 2 colleagues can be elected running against Inuit on our merits, I would hope, in majority Native constituency shows a very healthy cooperative attitude towards relations between the non-Inuit and the Inuit in the Eastern Arctic. So really, if you count those 3 ridings, we really have a very high majority of Native persons represented in the Assembly and in the government. We have a cabinet, or it's an executive council, as it's called, which has 8 ministers or 8 members. 7 of those are elected MLAs, and 4 of those people are not only Aboriginal people, but I think they are people who are very active in Native organizations. Names like Nellie Cornier, Tagat Curley, Nick Sibiston, and Richard Nurse, who are well known in the Northwest Territories for their activism in Native organizations. How has this affected the government of the Northwest Territories? I would say, Mr. Chairman, that the Native majority in the Assembly have never really imposed themselves in a way to create resentment, but their presence is strongly there. And I'd just like to cite a few instances of some of the things that have been done, sometimes quietly. One of the first initiatives that was taken by the new Legislative Assembly in 1979 was to completely revisit the policy of the territorial government with respect to land claims negotiations. Now, as we've heard from Mark Gordon, the province of Quebec was one party to the negotiations of their claim, which complicated things enormously for them. I think in the Yukon as well, it was very evident from the presentation that the claim was negotiated with very active participation from the Yukon government and a heavy influence from the Yukon territorial government. But in the Northwest Territories, in its second session, the Legislative Assembly adopted a new policy for the territorial government, which was basically to remove it from an active third-party role and to acknowledge that in Canada, Aboriginal people's claims are matters between themselves and the federal government. And the territorial government was very clearly instructed by the Legislative Assembly to be only a part of the federal team, not to be a third party at negotiations. And indeed, although this has never been used, the directions from the Legislative Assembly even permit the possibility that the territorial government might be asked by an Aboriginal organization negotiating Aboriginal claims to leave the talks. Now, that fortunately hasn't happened because good relations have been developed and the government of the Northwest Territories has tried hard and I think succeeded in supporting the reasonable proposals of Aboriginal rights organizations. But I think it's worth noting that the new Legislative Assembly very quickly moved to avoid the sort of problems that have complicated claims in other jurisdictions that we've heard about this week. A few other initiatives of the Legislative Assembly worth noting are redistribution of seats, which favored the rural rather than the urban areas in the creation of new seats. Affirmative action programs in education, grants for Native people and employment for Native people, strong support for Indigenous languages, preservation and enhancement, and perhaps one of the more spectacular moves of the Ninth Assembly, which was to en masse travel to Ottawa and engage in kind of a week-long sit-in at the House of Commons until Aboriginal rights was restored to the Constitution. We demanded and got a meeting with the Prime Minister, and I think our Assembly, by that fairly dramatic action, can take some credit for the reinstatement of Aboriginal rights in the Constitution, along with our MP and many others who worked.